Since there's no Rusana, let me just move on to the interview for this week. Now, this one's a bit on the different side. One of my recent interests is the impact or the influence of the Russian Revolution and the Soviet Union more broadly on the world outside of it. So not just in the Soviet sphere, say in Eastern Europe, and not just in communist countries, but also in capitalist countries, in particular, the role of the Soviet Union had over various left-wing groups throughout the world. And of course, the history of the American left and the American labor movement is intimately tied with, of course, the history of communism in general, but also the Soviet Union. An old comrade of mine named Sean Richmond has recently published a book on the Hotel Workers Union in New York City from about 1913 through the 1950s. And besides being an incredibly important chapter of in the history of American labor, in his story, American communists, and of course, by extension, the Communist International, played a role in this movement. And in some cases, directives and negotiations and orders were being sent from the Comintern to the United States as things were unfolding. So this is a good look at the American labor movement and also the influence of, say, the Soviet Union and the Comintern on American politics, or at least American left politics. So Sean Richmond is a historian of U.S. labor and American communism, with a particular focus on union organizing and the service sector of the American Federation of Labor. He's the author of We Always Had a Union, The New York Hotel Workers Union, 1912 to 1953, published by University of Illinois Press. Here's Sean Richmond. Sean, it's great to talk to you. As I was just saying before we started recording, I don't think we've seen each other in like over 20 years when we were in the Socialist Party together.
Back in the late 1900s.
In the late 1900s. So you left the Socialist Party in the mid-2000s. You tried to get back in. And so what did you do after that in terms of your political activism?
I went into union organizing work. And actually, the first union I worked for was Local 6 of the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union, which is a part of the New York Hotel Trades Council, which is the union that culminates in this book that goes from 1912 to 1953 over a series of independent unions that eventually became this real powerhouse union in New York.
So is this how the genesis of the book came up?
Yeah. When I was there, there was a legend that we told ourselves that there was a long ago president of Local 6 who was arrested at the union headquarters and deported for being a communist. And that was mind-boggling at the time. When we were out, you know, our endorsement that year was for the re-election of Republican Governor George Pataki. And this is a union that just went all out for Cuomo in the recent New York mayoral. So that it had communist roots was somewhat unthinkable. So I wound up in graduate studies at UMass in the labor program. And so for the history course, I had to do an original research paper. And I found that this was a much bigger story than it feels like actually a real missing link of labor history, because this story goes back to 1912. It goes back to an independent labor movement affiliated with the industrial workers of the world. This is a group of workers that continually formed new independent unions that changed their organizing model and their strategies that moved through almost every fashionable left-wing ideology. So they go from being anarchists to being founding members of the Communist Party and being there at crucial points throughout the 1920s and later. And that each split then also has its effects, so that by the time you get to 1934, there are Trotskyists over here in this union. The Lovestonites are also participating. The CP's TUUL union is doing its thing. There's this AFL union that is a breakaway of people from the independent union who left over Communist Party stuff, wind up being dominated by the Dutch Schultz mob. That corrupt union, that conspiracy was broken up by Thomas Dewey, who was just a specially appointed prosecutor at the time, obviously takes that all the way to almost the White House, knowing fully well that he's handing the keys to the AFL Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union to the communists. In the 1930s are a funny time that was perfectly okay with him in 35, 36. So all these places where this feels like it should be a huge story, and yet at best, it's a footnote here and there, or you pick up on historians nodding to it and kind of saying like, oh, there's a story, someone should do this. But nobody did for, I'm not sure what reason. My best guess is that it's wrapped up in labor history's general bias towards sort of more masculine seeming work than the service industry, even though these workers were very macho throughout their time.
Let's back up a bit. Let me tell listeners, the book that Sean has just published in the last year or so, or maybe 6 months, I can't remember, is We Always Had a Union, The New York Hotel Workers Union, 1912 to 1953. And I should say, why are we interviewing Sean about this book? Because, you know, we usually talk about things that are directly related to Russia or Eurasia, et cetera. There is a Soviet connection to this story that we're going to get into a bit. But before we get into it, let's give us some context. Since you've already told us like where this book came out of in terms of your own personal experience, let's talk about the context in New York, early part of the 20th century, that led to the foundation of this hotel and restaurant union.
The Gilded Age. These massive luxury hotels all sprang up relatively quickly. The Waldorf is 1893, revolutionizes the industry in terms of the banquet spaces and Peacock Alley and all that stuff. Also, key to it is that the famous maitre d' of the Waldorf, Oscar Cherkey, makes a requirement of his kitchen staff and dining room staff that they have to speak at least French, German, and English. Italian and Spanish and other languages are pluses. So one of the things that he does is he hires a workforce that is cosmopolitan, that's very international, that's immigrant, and that is impatient for revolution. So they're waiting hand and foot on some of the worst Gilded Age people imaginable, right? And the owners of these hotels are, they're the Astors, they're the DuPonts. These are people who actually tore down their own mansions on Fifth Avenue and took the land and turned them into these large hotels. And then they moved uptown. And these are factories of pleasure. And the workforces within them at peak times, the industry goes slack in the summer, but at peak times when there are multiple banquets a day and all the guest rooms are filled, the workforce is 2,000, maybe 3,000 workers, right? Because even the elevators need to be operated by a human being. The laundry rooms, the heaters in the basement and the electrical work, huge workforces. And it totally intimidates the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union of the AFL, which gets chartered around the same time, a little bit earlier, the 1880s. They cut a deal with a tavern owner. Here's a shingle you can hang outside your door. The American Federation of Labor certifies that this is a union bar. And workers were really discriminatory about the union label. They wouldn't get drunk in a stab bar, but they would get drunk in a good union bar. So this union of bartenders, led by bartenders, most of them Irish, didn't know how to deal with this workforce. And the secretary treasurer of the union was an inveterate racist at the time. And so the union doesn't really approve until that guy finally dies. Jerry Sullivan is his name, where he's actually in this first 1912 strike. He's rooting against the workers, you know, and just he's editorializing in the union's newspaper that you send them all home. They don't belong here. You know, good riddance. He has no solution for how to organize this work. And so the workers...
Let me ask you a question about this, because you said, and I read this about other unionization attempts and also within the Communist Party, the issue of languages. Because as you said, you have this multi-ethnic immigrant, mostly workforce that speaks all bunch of different languages. I mean, how did they deal with that issue of this multi-ethnicity of the white ethnics of this labor force?
For a while, they conducted meetings in multiple languages. So Ludwig Lohr, as an example, who's sort of a key figure in the early CP, he's active in this union, is that when they held their rallies, he was the German speaker, and he was a draw. But they also, constitutionally, they mandated that business and union meetings were conducted in English. That would be the great unifier. And again, you know, these people are waiting on the Astors and the DuPonts. They have to speak English. They might have been more comfortable in another language, so the union had to have strategies around campaign literature being published in multiple languages and so on. But English was the unifier of this union. Given the nature of these workers, because they're European, a lot of them came from like the Jewish Pale of Settlement. It's a very common, as I look into their biographies, Trotsky and other of our favorites, they were wanted men back home and they had to get out, you know, and maybe they were school teachers or whatever back home, but here they were waiters. Organizing independently made sense. Gravitating towards the IWW also made sense, particularly it's the second strike in 1913 where the IWW comes in. And it's after the first strike is not such a success. The cooks are largely Italian. They want Joseph Ettore. They want Carlo Tresca. They want those guys to come in. And they wind up getting Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who is the strike leader for the second strike. Rose Pastor Stokes actually was the strike leader for the first strike. So despite this being a very male workforce, their first leaders were ironically women.
And for listeners who don't know Elizabeth Gurley Flynn or Rose Pastor Stokes, these are two well-known women radicals of this period that really go up into the 1920s and into the 30s for sure in their activities.
Flynn later, Stokes passes away. And both of them wanted to have more women involved in the organizing. Those early strikes were mostly based in the dining room. The unions had ambitions to go wall to wall, right? Because they are wobblies. They are industrial workers. They saw it that way. They were sort of uneven consciousness of the workers. And actually, at some point, when the union regroups after a 1918 strike, I find references to a captive audience, meaning that all of the hotel managers did throughout the city, where they created essentially a company union for their front guest staff and their housekeepers called the Greeters Society. And they bought them off with a fancy, you know, a Christmas party every year. You know, the iron fist in the velvet glove. They scared the crap out of those workers. They dropped out. And at that point, this union that went by the name of the International Hotel Workers Union and a bunch of International Federation of Workers in the Hotel and Restaurant Industry, at this point decides they're a food workers union. And they merge with a like-minded group of anarchist bakers. And they become the Amalgamated Food Workers Union. And that's the union that they are throughout the 1920s up to 1934.
Well, I wanted to go back to specifically the Hotel and Restaurants Union and the process of organizing the union. I assume there were some serious obstacles to forming the union. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
The first strikes were real cause celebs in the city. They really got everybody's, they were front page news. And a number of hotels did settle, and most hotels raised wages and fixed some of the workers' complaints. The fining system was one of their biggest complaints, that managers maintain discipline is they dock your pay for any little thing. You spill a bit of coffee, that's dull, you know, and it really ate into the workers' wages. The 1913 strike fails ultimately because this thing is such news. When Joseph Ettore finally comes down from Lawrence, Massachusetts, and he addresses this major rally of the workers, they do these meetings in stages. They only fit 1,500 people into the hall. So they do three meetings in a row. But you got 1,500 workers in this room, and you have 20, 25 reporters, because that's how many newspapers there are in New York City. And in the course of his speech, he says that it would be the unsafest proposition in the world for the capitalists to eat food prepared by your hands if they make you go back to work on a non-union basis. And you can imagine how the New York Times responded to that. They're like, are you threatening to poison us? And, you know, he was probably playing around with ideas of sabotage that were in the atmosphere as it was. I found some very funny references to sabotage as union strategies. My favorite is at one point, a bunch of cooks were throwing fistfuls of asafoetida into the upholstery of the mirror. It's an Indian spice. I don't know how they had it. The food was very bland at the time, but it's an Indian spice that is largely used to substitute for onions, where one tiny pinch substitutes for an entire onion. A fistful of it, you hear the word fetid as a root of it. That's in there for a reason. Not permanent damage, but there's going to be no meal that day with the house smelling that way. Got another one where they heard that the bosses were bringing in some scabs from out of town, and they greet them at Penn Station with cayenne pepper and just in their body. Well, sabotage was out there, and that was probably what Ettore was playing with, but the capitalists took that to be a threat of poison, and Stark lost middle-class support, which it needed to win. And the workers split with the IWW at that point.
Can I clarify something? For someone who hasn't been involved in the labor socialist movement. So when you talk about strikes, are we talking about strikes that they did as union workers, or are we talking about strikes that kind of led up to the formation of the union?
We're talking about strikes that they did as workers who considered themselves a union, but there was no legal process for forming a union. There was almost no formal collective bargaining. Union contracts were rare. They mainly existed in places like in construction, where the employer associations would make deals that would last for a couple of years with the trades. And it was that sort of hiring hall situation where if you're a unionized electrical contractor, you call up IBEW Local 3 and say, we need three guys on this site tomorrow, and they send them. Formal union representation in 1912 was for this very narrow strata of workers, a more privileged group of workers, a more skilled group of workers. These were strikes for union recognition, They were called in very funny ways. They were inventing this as they went. They were very impressed with the first time they did it because they didn't know if people would be too scared to do it. But it was basically they'd have their shop stewards have a whistle around their neck under their uniform. And then at the appointed time, you blow the whistle and that's the notice. And key to it was always, you always do it in the middle of the meal. You take the food orders, you put out the soup, and then you leave. And they weren't really one day longer, one day stronger strikes, which is what strikes generally are, mainly because of the law these days. It was, we're striking the Waldorf on Tuesday. We're going back on Wednesday. We're striking the Plaza on Wednesday. We're going back there on Thursday. We're going to strike lunch at the Waldorf. We're going to come back for dinner. And just leaving the bosses guessing. Okay, my guess is that they couldn't be sure they could turn out 100% of the workers. So they were trying to force the bosses to just shut down the operation. No lunch today, just because of the unpredictability of it. And so in that way, this is one of the most successful unions of the 1920s. The 1920s is a time where unions start the decade very powerful, large percentage of unionized workers under contract. And the bosses do a decade-long open shop drive, a union-busting campaign that reduces unions to a density that looks like today, frankly.
You've already mentioned a couple of like key radical names, Ludwig Lohr, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Rosa Pastor Stokes. These are the ones that I'm familiar with. And of course, all of them at some point are connected to the American Communist Party. And of course, the big event is the Russian Revolution. What was the impact of the Russian Revolution? How did it influence these workers, the union, and the way they went about their organizing, if at all?
It changed everything. So the union is on strike again in 1918. They do a big march through the city on Thanksgiving Day, where there's, again, this is front page news, even with a war going on. And all of the news is about, are they going to march with red flags? Because the mayor of New York, John Hyland, had banned red flags because there's obviously this massive hysteria about Bolsheviks and spreading Bolshevism, et cetera. And everybody knew that of all the workers in the city of New York that would wave a red flag, it was these food workers. And, you know, if they wave the red flag, the cops are going to bust down on them. There's going to be violence in the streets. And so they actually managed to like cool their jets, keep the, they have American flags. They don't do red flag for that march only. But they are day one joiners. I love the Warren Beatty movie, Reds. I love that line about the fine distinction of which half of the left gets Moscow's pick as the Communist Party in America. These guys joined the John Reed Party, which, you know, the other party, which is called the Communist Labor Party, the other party is the one that has the reputation of being mostly immigrants. It was largely the foreign language federations of the Socialist Party that formed. These guys are immigrants too, but they're bohemian immigrants. They fit in very well with John Reed's bohemians. But also they embrace the fight club nature of early Communist Party organizing, which is, you know, the first rule is you don't talk about it. So they don't talk about it, but they do in their paper, they hail the formation of the Workers' Party in 1921, which is the public-facing, acceptable way to join the communists. But they find themselves at odds with the Workers' Party almost immediately. And it's because of, this coincides with William Z. Foster joining and with Vlad Lenin publishing Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder, which is sort of basically advice to activists around the world to stop taking preposterous positions. And one of the preposterous positions was stop forming new pure unions. Look at France, where left-wingers contested for power within the mainstream unions and won. You know, Sam Gompers is happy to see you spinning your wheels trying to form a new union. But you should be fighting for entry within those unions and taking them over. William Z. Foster winds up directing a lot of his attention on the Amalgamated Food Workers Union, trying to convince them to shut down their union. Not just that, but the Amalgamated Food Workers Union was, at this time period, trying to form a new federation of independent unions. It went by a couple of different names. One, ironically, was the Labor Unity League, but it was the Industrial Union Council. They looked like it had about 70,000 members. A lot of the unions also have the word amalgamated in their name for his sort of historical reasons. But it was an attempt to create a more practical or pragmatic industrial workers of the world. We're dealing with a sort of a counterfactual of what would have happened if the Communist Party didn't tell them to shut it down. I think it would have grown to be somewhat significant, a sort of a pre-CIO. It would have been something that the actual CIO had to deal with come 1935, because it would have been big and too big to ignore. But they were convinced to not form a new federation that competed with the AFL, but the Amalgamated Food Workers won for themselves a major exception to the policies. They said, look, We have 20,000 members. We are the Hotel Employees Union in New York. The AFL's Hotel Employees Union has dozens. You can't tell us to surrender and go in there. Plus, they won't accept us as members because we're not citizens. It just doesn't make sense. And they won that point. It was the major exception to Communist Party labor policy in the 1920s.
So you already mentioned Lindsay Foster, that name. For our listeners who are not very familiar with these key figures, could you tell us a bit more about this person and what is his importance to your story?
Foster is, he's my favorite tragic hero in the labor movement. He's sort of the Anakin Skywalker of American socialism. He was a brilliant union organizer. I think he was the first modern trade union organizer. When I read his descriptions of how he organized in the stockyards of Chicago and in the steel mills of Chicago and Western Pennsylvania, it looks a lot more like what my job was as a union organizer in the 21st century. Organizing committees, secret meetings, make a plan, stick to it, building towards trying to catch the bosses by surprise when you go on strike. So he had these two famous organizing campaigns, the stockyards and steel, which he organized through the American Federation of Labor. And he did it in this really brilliant way, where instead of trying to form a new union and fight this abstract fight of craft union versus industrial, he negotiated to get every craft union that had a valid claim to workers. One guy changes the light bulbs. Okay, fine. There's one electrician in here. 17 unions, I think, in the case of the stockyards. 24 unions, I think, in the case of steel. And got them to agree that basically we get the members, but we'll create this superstructure, this council that will be the union, so that we get one big union. We get one big strike, but we also get to maintain our craft unions. Stockyards campaign is a success. The steel campaign is not, largely just timing. The World War comes to an end, production scales down, and so the bosses were happy to have the strike because they didn't want to pay the workers anyway. And this is a man who, in 1916, 1917, 1918, he looked like Sam Gompers' heir apparent. And, you know, he was derided by leftists because he was working within the AFL. He had been a wobbly. He made this big switch because he went to France and saw the CGT, and he said, why aren't our unions like that? And he became this big advocate of boring from within the American Federation of Labor. And he's kind of spinning his own wheels with these small organizations. We had a lot of followers in Chicago and nothing else. But when Lenin publishes Left-Wing Communism, and he finds his idea endorsed, and he's convinced to go out to Moscow, where he sees one of the first Comintern meetings, he comes back secretly, quietly, a communist. And he becomes the driver of the party's labor policy. So that's where my unionists initially start bumping heads with him. But once they got through that fight that they won that major exception, he was a major advisor to them for decades. So much so that the New York Hotel Trades Council that I referenced, this powerhouse union in New York, it's a council of, originally it was something like 11, I think they've slimmed down to 8, individual unions of the AFL-CIO. There's an electrician's local, there's an operating engineer's local, and so on. The very principle of the Stockyards Trades Council. This thing was created, obviously, with William Z. Foster's input. And it is quietly, I think, the most lasting legacy that Foster has left within the AFL-CIO. Hiding in plain sight. He's there throughout. And I tell the story towards the end of this book. This covers a long period here. That this union remained communist-led up until 1952. So even after the CIO purged the left-led unions, this here in the AFL, this was, everybody knew it. It was CP-led. There was a broker deal where it could remain CP-led. So the break with the CP winds up looking more like a divorce or like a dispute within the family. And it's driven by William Z. Foster's personality and his paranoia and his mistrust of some key leaders in particular. And so he pressed for a change in leadership of the union. When you challenge a union president for re-election, you best not miss. And they missed. And it was a split right down the middle. Half the VPs stayed in the Communist Party and wound up getting expelled from the union. Half quit and remained union leaders until their retirement in the 60s.
Let's talk about the communists. I mean, since Foster is such a critical player in the Communist Party in the 1920s and into the 30s, there are two main people struggling to lead the party, him and first Charles Ruthenberg and then Jay Lovestone. What role did the party, and of course, in talking about the American Communist Party, you also have to include the Comintern. What was their influence? How did they influence this labor union?
I went into this thing, I read a lot of the literature, you know, a lot of stuff you pointed me in the direction of, where there's sort of two camps of communist historians. There's sort of the orthodox folks who look at everything as orders from Moscow and the Comintern was deciding everything. Then there are the revisionists who make arguments that a lot of this was actually from the bottom up and organic, and it was somewhat of a negotiation between the rank and file activists in America and the party line getting dictated from Moscow. And so I sort of was more sympathetic to the revisionists. But then I get in there and I got to say, every narrative beat of the story matches all of them. You know, who breaks away in 1939 over the pact with the Nazis? Who breaks away in 1947 over this thing? It just hit every beat. And so one of the key ones actually is the Communist Party is in the third period in the early 1930s, where they're fighting liberals and social democrats more almost than they are the bosses. And so they're splitting unions, they're splitting political parties, they're splitting everything. And it's about, we are hyper left-wing and everybody else is a sellout or a social fascist. And there's this turn, of course, in 1935 towards the Popular Front, where we're all working together. And there's a period of transition. And it's not an abrupt change. One of the things that we debate as historians is how much of that gradual shift was from facts on the ground and the experience of the activists, and how much of it was Moscow saying, well, let's experiment with this thing because we think we're going to have to make a change in the strategy. I thought that the National Recovery Administration, which is sort of the first attempt at labor law from the Roosevelt administration, where it's not collective bargaining towards a contract, it's sort of industrial rulemaking, where they create a body, say, okay, there's going to be a hotel labor board, and it's going to determine the basic rules for all hotels, the basic minimum salary, the basic minimum hours, et cetera. And they would meet with anyone that had a valid claim to workers. There were no elections. There was no majority vote and exclusive representation. And so it forced these unions to work together so that the communist-led TUUL union called the Food Workers Industrial Union is there. The Amalgamated Food Workers Union, which by that point, the communists had left, and the Lovestoneites and the Trotskyists and the Social Democrats were operating. The Mustyites were in there. Who sort of the broad anti-Stalinist left was running that union. And HERE, with their dozens of members, they were forced to coordinate. And I thought, well, that experience of being forced to coordinate and then having this major strike in 1934, where they were competing with each other for shop floor leadership and militancy and who could break the most windows, et cetera, that at the end of it, their lesson was, well, we're stronger when we're together, and that they start merger negotiations. First, the Amalgamated and the FWIU merge, and then they appeal to HERE to merge into it. They seek to enter into the AFL after all those many years, this very surprising change. So I thought this happened organically. And then I get the Comintern records, which is they have these personnel files for anybody that went abroad for Comintern work. So there's not a lot here, a page or two on any given individual. Mostly it just confirms that they did, in fact, do overseas assignments for the Comintern, which is always very, also it's their biography. So that's how I know that Michael J. Obermeyer joined in 1919 and therefore he was in the Labor Party. Fascinating stuff there. Jay Rubin, who is the leader of the Food Workers Industrial Union by this point, who is the one who is negotiating the merger. And fascinatingly, they're conducting the negotiations in public, through their newspapers. So they put their bargaining position in each one. And so when Rubin says, not only should there be one union, but that union should be in the AFL, it's like, wow. And you get the impression that he's in New York doing this, but he's actually in Moscow.
The time lag must have been quite incredible because, you know, in order to do that, you have to, unless they wired everything.
I think they were wiring everything.
I mean, I've seen a lot of these wires. I also see stuff that comes from like Comintern representatives, and I'm just like, my God, they're like churning out these letters, and how long does it take to actually get to the United States for them to react?
Well, that's a 1920s problem. Like, by 1935, 1936, you know, the communication sped up a little.
So Sean, your book starts with the 1910s and then spans the next four decades. I'm actually curious about why you pick 1953 as your end date. Probably has nothing to do with Stalin, but... In my head,
You always have to ask.
You always have to double check. But anyways, so I wanted to ask a question about the later period. How did the Union weather the Red Scare in the United States and the early stages of the Cold War?
They fought better than the unions and the CIO did. they faced a lot of the same attacks. And it's almost this immediate thing, right? One of their main allies within the hotel and restaurant employees union was this guy named Miguel Garriga, who was a staffer on the International Union, who was assigned to New York to work with them on the merger and then on the organizing drive. And he is a quintessential Popular Front era fellow traveler, approving quotes in the Daily Worker, doing rallies. He's of Spanish descent, so he's very into Civil War work. But the Nazi-Soviet pact is just an immediate breakthrough. He just goes insane and goes to war on his former comrades. And they're heading towards this major conflict where he wants an anti-communist clause in the International's Constitution. And Obermeyer is the secretary treasurer of the local at first. They're going to run against each other, et cetera. Pearl Harbor happens and it was all a dream. It's like that episode of Dallas. It was all a dream. And they're working together fine again throughout the war. But it's July, it's August 1945. We're immediately right back to your previous positions. One of the things that happens is that the International Union president dies of cancer. He's actually incapacitated throughout summer. I think he died in October. And so already the succession fight over who would be the next president is here. And it's very clear that communism is going to be the major fight of the International Union Convention. And there is, in fact, an anti-communist clause. There is a trusteeship of the local joint board, which is one of the umbrella council organizations. There is crucially not a trusteeship of Local 6, which is where 30,000 of the hotel worker members were. And that was the communist stronghold within HERE. And largely is because the man who became president of the union, Hugo Ernst, was really an exceptional fellow. He was just a good man. He was an old-time socialist, Eugene Debs, Norman Thomas socialist. He was a believer in industrial unionism. I believe he was also, the union's official history describes him at various points as a dandy, as a lifelong bachelor, who loved to travel. This is a man who was an outsider who appreciated other outsiders. And he had been allies of these communists since 1923. He just recognized everything they had done to build up the union, and he wasn't willing to throw them out. Crucially, the anti-communist clause of the HERE Constitution put trusteeships in the president's decision-making, and he was like, I'm not going to do it. They survive, and he eventually even shuts down the trusteeship of the local joint board. He brokers this sort of deal where the communists and the anti-communists would share power within New York. There's a period of some peace there, even with Obermeyer getting arrested. Obermeyer is arrested in 1947, and he spends the rest of his time fighting for his life, basically. And Ernst supports him, you know, contributes to the legal campaign, all that. The New York State AFL is hugely embarrassed by the existence of these communists in their ranks. And actually, one of the things I think that becomes clear to me, and if people read this book, maybe they'll agree, is the reputation is generally that the CP in the labor movement was limited to the CIO, with a few small exceptions. If they know about it, they say the hotel employees, obviously the Writers Guild out in Hollywood. I would say, actually, they were limited to New York, which makes sense because the Communist Party's membership was in New York.
Yeah, I want to ask you about your evaluation of the influence of the Communist Party and through it, the Comintern. Because as I told you in an email just a few hours ago, from the research I've been doing within the American Communist Party, in the 1920s, primarily, I'm talking about, it was a total shit show. The factionalism was so bad that I'm amazed anything was able to get done. And then you have this zigzagging nature of the Comintern and the party having to navigate the whims of Moscow for a variety of reasons. And you're kind of coming into this, especially as you said earlier about how the history of the American Communist Party is split between everything comes from Moscow. What is your kind of evaluation on the legacy of the party's influence in your story?
There's a couple of different ways I want to respond to that. I mean, one thing I did in the book, narratively, that, you know, I wonder how people will take it. I get turned off when writers of communist history weigh in too hard with a sort of a moral summation, whichever side they take on it. It just leaves me sort of cold. I sort of prefer to approach this as a journalist, is just like, what happened and why? And show rather than tell and let the readers decide. One of my favorite comments from one of the readers was basically on that question. They were like, you know, Richmond won't say, but it seems like this union did well almost in spite of the Communist Party, which might be the case. I want to give one example of an obscure major split in the communist ranks that had actual fatal impact on this union. And then I'll give my answer to why I think the summation is. So the fatal choice here is Moorism, which is, you got to be a real in the weeds kind of historian if you know about Dolorism.
He's the American communist
Trotsky. He's the stand-in for Trotsky because he's personal friends with Trotsky.
Right.
When Trotsky briefly was a New Yorker. And he hounded out of the party and blah, blah, blah. But he was a member of the Amalgamated Food Workers Union. And so two other members of the Amalgamated Food Workers Union, people also who had connections to Trotsky, they saw these attacks on this guy and the implicit attacks on Trotsky. And they were like, to hell with it. This is too many isms at this point. And so this one guy in particular, Paul Kulcher, he was a refugee from Russia because he participated in the 1905 revolution. So he's doubly picking up on the anti-Trotsky and the anti-Lore stuff. And he's out. He gets a charter from the American Federation of Labor, from the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union, Local 16, to compete with the Amalgamated Food Workers Union. And they curse him as a Benedict Arnold, whatever. And, you know, his only recruits are ex-AFW members. And you can watch the membership climb. They get up to 500, they get down to 200, and they stay somewhere between 1 and 200 members, which would be a footnote in history, except that was just big enough to be attractive to Arthur Dutch Schultz Flegenheimer, who, as prohibition was coming to an end, he needed a new racket and protection in labor and protection in cafeterias was very attractive to him. And so actually they build up Local 16 and Local 302 to hundreds, if not thousands, of paper members. And it's a very violent gang. In the narrative here, I've got one member driven out north of the city, taken for a ride and shot in the back. I got one member who commits suicide rather than be forced to testify. Got a drive-by shooting at the International Union's convention in Rochester. There are threats to cut off your ears if you don't do what we want, if you don't take this picket line down. And all of this can be traced to the Communist Party line. And again, when the third period begins and they're told to split, people are outraged. You're like, we just had a labor unity league 5 years ago. You told us to shut it down. Now you want it to start and we're going to have this separate unit, right? So now you're making us split again. And then the merger in 34, 35, same sort of issues. Like, are you kidding me? So it had a massive impact. Now, the influence and the power of the Communist Party, my big takeaway is for a shoestring operation and a fledgling independent union like this to survive through several economic recessions and wars over the course of decades, the big difference was that the Soviet Union, as a sort of a guiding star, as almost a religious sort of feeling of that is the promised land, I think gave these activists a stick-to-it-ness that a lot of other folks might have just given up on the union organizing gig at some point.
I actually came across a document somewhere in my research over this whole debate of socialism, one country, which for Leninist type leftists is always a big deal, like arguing socialism versus one country in one country versus international revolution, blah, 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 blah. And this document in the American Communist Party is really interesting because it said, look, we're for socialism in one country. Why? Because we need the Soviet Union to succeed. It's better to have one socialist country succeeding because this is, like you just said, there is this almost, it's guiding star. It's almost a religious, as you said, reverence. And it's surprised how often American communists just deferred themselves to the Comintern rather than their own kind of local political configurations.
Right. There are people, and it was not even so much the party members as the fellow travelers. There were people who really did prioritize the Soviet Union and Soviet interests over our national and domestic politics. Not to go off on too much of a tangent, but at some point, one day, I think we'll recognize that the closest analogy for it, and just striking how similar it is Israel in this country, in terms of how any criticism of actions by that government are just, because once you admit that there's a mistake in a single decision of the government, it's almost as if everything underneath it collapses, which isn't true, but that is definitely the feeling amongst its strongest, most partisan supporters of the Soviet Union back in the day and the state of Israel today.
That's actually a really interesting analogy that I hadn't thought of, and I can totally see that. All right, Rusana, last question to you.
Finally, our last question. We always ask our guests, what lessons can we learn from your story for our present predicaments?
I wrote a book before this called Tell the Bosses We're Coming that was more of like a current event sort of thing that was taking my experience as a union organizer and really sort of venting my spleen about why unions are just following the same strategies over and over again without change, and how we have to be more experimental and be willing to break some shit.
Throwing cayenne pepper at least.
Totally.
Or why are we fighting for exclusive representation when we're in a right to work state? Like, you know, exclusive representation is actually in the boss's interest, because bosses, their favorite number of unions to deal with is zero, but their second favorite number is one. They don't like a situation like the 1934 hotel strike where they couldn't settle it because they made a deal with one union and other unions say, not good enough, and we're going to break your windows. But I didn't want to be in a position of rewriting that book constantly. I don't want to be one of those guys where a new book comes out and you're saying the same old shit and nobody's listening. And so this book is a passion project that's been with me for almost 25 years now. Part of the reason I did it is it's a way of saying the same thing, but using this historical example, because this is a union that constantly changed their strategies. They were going for union recognition and a collective bargaining agreement industry-wide and using sabotage as a strategy. And then they shift gears to, no union recognition whatsoever, hiring hole, and you can lock us out at any minute and we can go on strike at any minute. And that's fair deuce. By the time the Hotel Trades Council comes around, they negotiate a system of labor peace that still exists. That's really remarkable. There are courts. Grievances go to a court of the hotel industry with decisions that set precedence. So that there's a clear understanding of what's right and what's wrong, and what are standards that could get an employee fired, and what are standards of progressive discipline that an employer must follow or else their decisions get revoked. So much so that there's only been one strike since the Hotel Trades Council got founded. In 1985, there are strikes over union recognition, but when that contract comes up to get renegotiated, it's generally done relatively peacefully. Don't tell ourselves this is how unions always did it, that therefore this is how we should organize Amazon or Starbucks or whatever. There's no such thing as how we always did it. It always changed depending on the circumstances and the law and the workers' own bravery. A lot of what we're doing still ain't working for us, and we got to be more willing to try. And one of the things I would say, even as I was a union organizing director, something I would say to my staff is there aren't actually any new ideas out there, but there are a lot of old ideas that we've forgotten about.
That was Sean Richman. Sean Richman is a historian of U.S. labor and American communism, with a particular focus on union organizing and the service sector in the American Federation of Labor. He's the author of We Always Had a Union, The New York Hotel Workers Union, 1912 to 1953, published by the University of Illinois Press. I'm your host, Sean Guillory, and this is The Eurasian Knot. This episode, like all our episodes, was edited and mixed by Daniel Cooper at Podcuts Editing. I've plugged Daniel many, many times. He does a great job for us. He's always on time, does good work, and is pretty reasonable in his prices. So if you have any audio needs, please check him out at podcutsediting.com. And of course, The Eurasian Knot is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, and listeners just like you. I won't go over the spiel again, but please help us out in any way you can, particularly if it comes out of your pocket. Monthly contributions help us very much. So, until next time, bye-bye.